From meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news, broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at scaredmonkeysradio.com, it's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, good evening, everyone. When I bring up the name Casey Anthony, you have to have been hiding under a rock for the last 3 years or 3.5 years, whatever it's been, to not recognize the name. You also have to have been hiding under a rock if you don't recognize the name Jeff Ashton. Jeff Ashton is a former prosecutor from the state of Florida, 30 years, long time. In that time, he tried more than 80 murder cases. He's retired now. He lives in Florida with his wife and children. He's the first lawyer to successfully try a case using DNA evidence, and his new book, Imperfect Justice, Prosecuting Casey Anthony, is a big hit. I know it is with our listeners, and it's a big kick to have Jeff on the show tonight. Good evening, sir.
Good evening. How are you?
I'm fine. Welcome to Saskatchewan. I bet you never thought that you'd ever be in Saskatchewan on the radio.
Well, that's the truth. So, but I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, 30 years ago, you took your bar exam. Or even before that, did you ever think that you'd get into such a mess as this case?
No, I got to tell you, there's nothing that prepares you for getting involved in something like this. It's something else.
Before we get into the book, I got to ask you. Yeah, you and I were talking off air a little bit. You know what I do for a living besides talking on the radio. And when we finally do walk away from our jobs, you never really walk away from it. Do you miss it?
I do a bit. I mean, I'm sure that I'm going to miss it a lot more in the future. You know, when I've sort of gotten all this behind me, but yeah, I miss going into court and fighting a good fight. It's something that you really gets into your blood.
You know, I've interviewed dozens of prosecutors on this program in the past 13 years from all over the world, Saskatchewan or Canada, United States, you name it. And one of the biggest traits and one of the biggest pluses for a prosecutor is the ability to communicate. If you can't communicate in the courtroom, you're going to have big problems. And I give you credit, my friend, you have a way, a gift of the gab, they like to say. And do you see that now with the high profile cases that are floating around out there? God, all you got to do is turn the TV on or look on the internet. And do you see the prosecutors doing a good job with these cases? Because being tried in the media is probably not like you tried them when you first got into this job.
Yeah, I mean, I see most of the prosecutors that I see in high-profile cases doing, you know, excellent work. I mean, you know, we're more constrained than defense attorneys are to not try cases in the press, and I really admire all those guys out there that have to, you know, go through these big cases and sit there and be quiet and not, you know, respond to defense attorneys who you know go on TV and make statements, because I can certainly sympathize with how difficult it is to just do the right thing and be quiet. But that's the job. That's what you have to do.
Wendy Murphy's a regular on this program, Jeff, and she talks about it all the time. And you just mentioned it, how the defense attorneys can blah 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 their way through the media, but the minute that the prosecutor does something like that, there's sanctions, there's all sorts of things that can happen. The system, is it fair when it comes to that? Because you know the case, when the investigators bring it to you, when the cops bring it to you and they want to present it and you go for an indictment or whatever you do in the jurisdiction that you're in, you're right, you have to keep quiet. That's the professional way to do it and the proper way to do it. But isn't there a time or two that you would have just loved to have gotten in front of the microphone in this case and said what you really felt?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's many times when I would have liked to have gotten up there and responded to a lot of the stuff that was being talked about, a lot of nonsense. But, you know, we have an obligation to try the case in the court and not in the court of public opinion. And you know, we at the end of the day, we kind of go to bed happy that we did the right thing. And maybe someday we'll come around to some rules that will keep everybody, you know, from giving their opinion and talking and just, you know, let the case be tried where it's supposed to be tried, in the courtroom.
A lot of criticism about the jury system, especially after this case. Is it time that it be revamped? You get 12 people that have to be experts for a month, a week, whatever, however long the case takes. Is it fair to those jurors? Is it fair to them to put them in that spotlight?
Well, you know, it probably isn't, but I just can't think of a better system for resolving these things. I know that, you know, people have talked about, you know, having professional jurors or panels of judges, but, you know, I'm just not sure that any of those is necessarily better than just a good jury. You know, one of the things I talk about in the book is my opinion about how the pretrial publicity really affected our ability to get a fair and impartial jury. And, you know, we always think in terms of the defendant being prejudiced by that, but it really does go both ways. And that's one of the reasons that, you know, I think part of what got to us was how liberal we are down here in Florida about giving information, mm-hmm. you know, to the media. You know, we have a very open file policy, and what we give the defense, we give to the media. And in most cases, that's fine, but, you know, sometimes there are cases where that's not in the best interest of everybody involved. And, that, you know, maybe it's time to kind of rethink that in Florida because we have this very liberal system. And so, no, I just don't think, you know, making major changes in the jury system is the answer.
If you're just tuning in, Jeff Ashton, former prosecutor, is here talking about his book, Imperfect Justice. Click on the link in the show notes on how to pick it up from Amazon and all your fine book retailers. All right, let's get into this. The first time you had the case handed to you, so to speak, of course, you have teams of investigators, other prosecutors, everything. And I know the book goes through. We want people to buy the book, so we don't want to give them everything. But let's talk a little bit about that first time you got that case. Is this something that was an Advil moment for you?
Well, I actually was brought into the case by Linda Burdick, who was the lead prosecutor in the case. Actually, it was her case, and she got it, you know, the couple of days after it happened. I got brought into it really more because of the forensic evidence that was being developed in the case and the kind of cutting edge stuff that was going on there. And so, you know, I sort of saw it from a distance at first, like everybody else did, and then got to be more involved in it myself. And, you know, I was just fascinated by what I was seeing and what I was hearing in the case. I mean, it was truly a one of a kind of case and a one of a kind of defendant. I mean, it was very, very interesting in all respects.
There's nothing ever similar in police work and in prosecutorial work, court cases, you name it. But when you looked at this, you looked at the defendant, you looked at her credibility. You looked at the no smoking gun, so to speak, but you looked at the evidence the way that it was presented to you. What was your thoughts at the time? Did you think that, I'm not going to use the term slam dunk because that's not fair to you, but did you think you had a pretty good shot at this?
Well, you know, I felt it was a good case, and I felt, you know, that particularly once Kaylee was found, that it was a good case. And, you know, the way I looked at it, you know, from my perspective, was that, you know, it was difficult to find any explanation for Casey's, you know, actions during that 31 days of not reporting Kaylee missing and, you know, going about and having a good time and all the lies. You know, to me, there just wasn't any other explanation for this than the murder. And so, you know, we felt it was a really good case. We knew it was going to be hard. We knew it was going to be a long trial, lots of bits and pieces, you know, a real sort of a puzzle that had to be put together by the jury. But, you know, we felt that, you know, we looked at it in a certain way and felt that most jurors would look at it that way. And unfortunately, those weren't the jurors that we got.
Yeah, right. And yeah. We'll get into that in a little bit. Now, when you saw the, again, pretrial publicity, and even before the arrest, I've, like I mentioned to you, Cindy Anthony was a guest on this program. We covered it from stem to stern. Tim Miller from Texas Equisearch got raked over the coals. And this poor Kronk, the meter reader, all the, you know, I always coined the term a dime store novel full of wing nuts in this case.
That's a good one.
And everybody came forward for their 17 seconds of fame. But when you looked at it, and I know when I interviewed Cindy Anthony twice or three times on the program, and at that time they were still looking for Kaylee, and I honestly believed at the time that they had this idea, just from the language. We call it in my line of work, you know, the verbal behavior that I'm hearing, the terms that she's using, that there's, you know, obviously there's more to this case. She knows more than what's going on. But when you got involved in this and you saw all the cast of characters, Jeff, how do you as a prosecutor sit down and decide who you're going to call for your side?
Well, that was a big challenge in this case. It's one of the interesting things I talk about in the book is sort of how we went about planning the trial, you know, in order to sort of present the evidence in a way that the jury could follow and connect the dots, but still in a way that you know, would be complete. And that was one of the hardest parts. I mean, you know, there were certain witnesses that we had to call, even though, you know, they were going to be problematic, you know, George and Cindy Anthony being two of the biggest ones.
Right.
We did make a decision, you know, fairly early on in the case that we weren't going to call Roy Kronk, because though he did find the body, you know, there were all these issues with his story and it didn't really make sense. And so that was one tactical thing we did do, knowing the defense would call him anyway, but at least giving us a chance to kind of, you know, take him on cross-examination and maybe make it look a little bit better. But yeah, that's a difficult part of a case, trying to figure out how to put stuff together. You know, you got to take into consideration the jury's emotional state. You got to take in their level of exhaustion. You know, you got to you know, figure out how much you know, science they can take, and when you got to give them a break, and you know, when you can give them something that's a little more emotional, and or what you hope is going to be emotional.
Yeah.
So yeah, that was an enjoy. That's part of the case I particularly enjoy, that sort of planning.
Getting it, putting it all together. Yeah, absolutely. Jeff Ashton's here. His book, Imperfect Justice, available Amazon and all your fine book retailers. I didn't interview George, but I spoke to him on the phone at length. And when you heard this allegation of sexual abuse, George, another one, love him, hate him, we all have to agree he got raked over the coals pretty good in the media. Trying to protect his daughter is one thing, but what she did to him in a public venue, or what her attorney, Jose Baez, and we'll get into that in a little bit, that tactic that was used. Your thoughts on George Anthony?
You know, I feel a great deal of sympathy for George. I think he was the only person in that family who was at some point willing to put the pieces together and see what they really showed. At various times, I mean, there were times when his ability to do that were less. I describe in the book in the beginning how I think he actually was looking at the facts from a rational perspective and seeing what they led to. You know, they weren't something that he wanted to see, but you know, he was beginning to see it. And I think there just came a point in time when, for him, it was a choice of either lose his family, lose his wife, lose his son, lose his daughter, having already lost his granddaughter, or just to what I, as I refer to, as drink Cindy's Kool-Aid and say, okay, I'm going to buy into this ridiculous denial that my wife is exhibiting, and just go along with it. And I think that happened a few months before, you know, Kaylee was found, and then once Kaylee was found, I think that broke him and led to him what I think was a very legitimate suicide attempt. I really did think he wanted to die on that day. Yeah. And from that point on, I think he just basically gave up trying to see the truth and just was ready to do whatever Cindy needed him to do to try and help Casey. Until, of course, you know, he became the person accused, and I think that was more than he could stomach. You know, he wasn't going to go along with being painted as somebody that would have dumped his precious granddaughter in a swamp. That was more than he could take. And I think that was where he basically decided, hey, I'm not going along with this anymore, and I'm just going to get up there and say what happened. Unfortunately, George is not good at hiding his contempt for people.
Yeah.
And I think his contempt for Jose sort of came out in the trial, unfortunately, because it really made George look like he was hiding something that I'm pretty sure he wasn't. He just hated that man so much.
and when you get back to that, and I was just about to ask you, good prosecutor that you are, you read into what I was going to say. Jose Baez, the tactics, the defense lawyer, the play to the camera, play to the media, again, not having to follow the rules that you have to. He's right back into another high-profile case again. There's an old joke about defense lawyers and going fishing, but we won't get into that right now. What about Jose Baez? You hold any grudges?
Well, no. I mean, I don't hold grudges. I don't think he, you know, the stuff he pulled, I think, is you know, more hurting him than me. I mean,
yeah.
You know, he is what he is. I try to be honest in the book, both in complimenting things he did right and in pointing out things he did wrong. And you know, the bottom line is that he really acted in a fashion that I felt was unethical. He completely ignored the judge's orders on numerous occasions and didn't seem to give a damn. And, you know, there are instances that I relate in the book where he just out and out lied to people. And, you know, it's easy to win when you don't follow any of the rules. And you know, in the end, I think that's what happened. Though I do think that, at least according to the jury, a lot of the stuff he pulled probably really didn't have that great an effect on them. But, you know, I'm just... Some people have said, well, you know, winning a race is a lot, and not in my opinion. You know, whether you win or whether you lose, you're either a good guy or you're not a good guy. And so I just kind of tried to tell it the way it is. But I also, you know, tried to be honest about my personal feelings so people know, you know, when they're reading my opinion of Jose, that it comes from someone that doesn't like him. So, you know, I think you owe that to the audience to let them know what your bias is.
Absolutely. Jeff Ashton's here talking about his new book, Imperfect Justice. During the trial, all the interviews that I did, all the prosecutors, defense attorneys, experts, talking heads, so to speak, on the program, we all thought that there might be a plea deal. How close were you?
Well, really not close at all from the defendant's perspective. I mean, you know, there were discussions during the trial, toward the end of the trial that I talk about, between Linda Dwayne Burdick and Cheney Mason, and eventually those were discussed with Ms. Anthony, and you know, her initial response to those, you know, led Mr. Mason to question her competence.
Yeah.
And you know, resulting in an evaluation. Eventually, my assumption is that she rejected it because we never heard anything more about it. So you know, I guess she had a great belief in her ability to lie, and you know, and I guess she was right. She hornswoggled them, as we say down here.
Yeah, we call it buffaloing up here. But anyway,
buffaloed them. That's right.
Whatever works. Jeff Ashton's here talking about Imperfect Justice for about another 5 minutes, and I think we'll be able to use up those 5 minutes on this topic. What about cameras in the courtroom?
You know, I don't have a problem with cameras in the courtroom. You know, we've been doing it down here in Florida since, I mean, as long as I've been practicing law, we've had that. And I don't really, you know, I think that's all that bad a thing. I mean, some people say, well, you know, lawyers are going to ham it up and play for the camera, but we're playing for an audience anyway. You know, we're playing for the jury. So I just don't think it makes that big a difference. My bigger concern is pretrial publicity more than it is cameras in the courtroom. I really think that pretrial publicity is something that we need to have a serious talk about. I mean, you know, you look today about, you know, that Penn State mess over there with all the allegations against that coach, and you just have to say at some point, you know, people need to rely on the court system to get the information out and get it determined and get it right, instead of just making decisions on what you hear in the news or what you hear from somebody's opinion. That's my biggest concern.
What do we see next for Jeff Ashton? You taking a run of politics?
Well, not really. Haven't really decided that yet. You know, I'm just trying to get through the book tour right now and talk about the book. And I've been signing a lot of books lately, and kind of enjoying meeting people. And then we'll just see what happens after that.
You know, my last question: worldwide coverage. For heaven's sakes, you're in Pump Handle, Saskatchewan, right now. That's not the name of the place, but
Pump Handle. But you're
going out all over the world on the internet and iTunes and all these things, and you're even on cable TV. You name it, you're all over the place. When you look at that, and you look at this case, and you look at Casey Anthony and the public's, I'll use that term, hatred for her, because I think her and her team thought that she'd be able to cash in on this with all the big book deals, and she may still yet. But why do you think that the public has now turned against her? Because there is a lot of weirdos out there that would probably buy her book.
Well, you know, I think... You know, I always like to say that there's very few things in life that any of us trust anymore. I mean, we don't trust politicians. You know, we don't trust lawyers. Sometimes we don't trust police officers. But the one thing that I think we all still have faith in is a mother's love for her child.
Yep.
And I think when you violate that in the way that she has, I mean, even if you didn't think that she murdered her daughter, even if, you know, it's just a matter of her disregarding her, it's just so offensive to people. And I think that's why people hate her. I think if this were not a child that were murdered, if everything else was the same and this was an adult, I don't think people would have that rage that they have at her. It's the violation of that very basic, you know, relationship between a mother and child. I mean, mothers are supposed to care for their children.
Absolutely.
Not... just go on with their lives like nothing happened. So I think that's the reason.
Absolutely. Jeff Ashton, the book is Imperfect Justice. Listen, I really appreciate it. I get a big kick out of meeting you, sir, and maybe we can talk again.
Love to. It's been a pleasure.
Talk to you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
That's former prosecutor Jeff Ashton talking about his book, Imperfect Justice. Click on the link in the show notes. You know, the Anthony case is one that we all covered, we all followed. We still talk about it. Justice for Kaylee. Well, there's no courtroom justice, so to speak, for Kaylee, but there's always justice, and we all know what that means. And will it someday be served on Casey Anthony? Hard to say. Jeff Ashton, class act. I hope he does continue on, and, you know, you don't see very many articulate, honest politicians out there. I hate to say that, and I'll get in trouble for saying it, but wouldn't he be good at that, someone who has been there, done that? Anyway, we're going to take a break, and we're going to come back with another prosecutor. Of course, you all know Robin Sachs, former prosecutor, and get an update on what's been going on with that Long Island serial killer case that she is involved in. I'll talk a little bit about Penn State and Natalie Wood and everything else out there that's got your interest. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. I'm Dana Pretzer. We'll be right back. Okay, we're back. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. Just having some connection problems with Robin, but we'll get her on the air here in a minute. But while we're waiting, you call me. 306-842-7884. 306-842-7884. If you're listening live, if you're listening to the podcast, don't call. So you have to be listening live. And what do you think? What do you think of Jeff Ashton? And do you have his book, Imperfect Justice? I know a lot of the monkeys do, that they've been reading it or have read it. I know Blink on Crime is going to be doing a review on it here pretty quick. Pretty class act. It was a case that we all followed. Pretty much from, you know, A to Z, interviewed all sorts of people, covered it every which way we can. Everyone looking for justice for Kaylee still are. And to see that verdict, just like OJ, you know, looking at the press release that HarperCollins sent me, and some of the... they send you, when you interview authors, they send you kind of a press kit out. and they talk about the book and talking points and questions that they would like you to ask or to, you know, to things they want you to cover. And, you know, when you look at the case and it says Ashton details why he believes the verdict went the way it did, explaining how the evidence, circumstantial without a clear cause of death, combined with an uninspired jury, produced the most shocking verdict since the O.J. Simpson case. Now, you know, talking about the jury being uninspired and no smoking gun, so to speak. But it's, you know, it's just something that I think we'll be talking about for a very, very long time. And while we've got a couple of minutes waiting for Robin, we certainly can talk to you about it. I won't keep you on the air long. 306-842-7884. Give me a quick call, and we can talk about imperfect justice. Would you like to see Jeff Ashton as a politician? I threw that question out because I've heard some rumors and some thoughts, and you know, ex-prosecutors do come back, and you know, you have a smart, articulate guy, someone who the public likes, intelligence, honest, would make a perfect politician. Although when you look at some of the politicians out there, it's everything that most of them aren't. Again, we'll take a quick break, and we'll try and get Robin on the phone. Gotta love cell phones, but we'll be back in just a minute. Okay, we're back. This is Scared Monkeys Radio, and while we're waiting for Robin Sachs, who we're having connection problems with, I thought I'd bring you up to date on someone I talked about in a commentary a few days ago, Mary Hammer of Lake City, Florida. And again, you can take this for what it's worth. It's on Radar Online. But our old friend Joran Vandersloot, remember I talked about the gal who thinks that Joran is, you know, a pretty good fella, and she's been paying all his bills. But there's more to this now. She says her guardian angel, she figures she's Joran's guardian angel, Mary Hammer, she's 55, of Lake City, Florida, that she, according to Radar Online, has spent so much of the salary from her part-time job footing the suspected killer's defense that she's even had to dig into her retirement fund to make ends meet. She says it's been a big financial burden for her. She lives in a small apartment and she drives an 8-year-old car, and she buys her clothes from thrift shops. She says that she spent more than $3,000 of her hard-earned wages visiting Joran last week, but the trip was a huge disappointment for her when first she claimed she found her ward drugged up and disoriented, and she was even banned from the prison. I visited Joran Saturday, and his health is deteriorating. She's worried about him. He said his doctor at the Castro prison has put him on a lot of medication, including tramadol, a painkiller, and Flexeril, a muscle relaxant, much to his guardian angel's disgust. She says he was groggy, he was stumbling, he knocked over a glass of water, and he had a rash around his neck. Gee, I wonder if he got his rash from something else. But anyway, his health has deteriorated, and his health is going down, according to his guardian angel. They don't want me to reveal that Paco cocaine paste is very common there, and that the place is a drug haven, she says, and I don't want Joran to take it as long as it leads to bad decision-making. She says when she talks about Joran, she calls him as her sweetie, and she went in to claim that the prisoners are put on solitary confinement if they complain about anything, and she doesn't want him to complain. And the creme de la creme of this is that she has appealed to President Humala and President Barack Obama for Joran to be released into her care, so that she can rehabilitate him. Assuming that unlikely scenario doesn't occur, the suspected killer will go to trial January 6th for Stephanie's murder, and Mary plans to spend yet more money to be there to support him. Gee, I can't see why the President of Peru and Barack Obama wouldn't get him released into her care. God, I wish I had a cuckoo sound effect. I got to get one. We'll start putting some sound effects on the show here. Anyway, I'm Dana Pretzer. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. We're going to try Robin one more time and see if we can get her on the air here. If we can't, we might have to cut the show a little bit sooner than what we want to do, but we'll give it a try one more time. We'll be right back. Okay, unfortunately, we're not able to get a hold of Robin Sachs tonight. I don't know, maybe she's caught up in another Occupy protest or something, but and maybe her cell phone has gone dead. I don't. My apologies to you. Oh, I hope you enjoyed the interview that we did with Jeff Ashton. I will stay on the air for another few minutes. Again, if you want to call in, I know a lot of people are a little afraid to call in. I'm pretty easy to get along with. We don't have a toll-free number here, but I won't keep you on the air long, and you can talk about anything you like. 1-306-842-7884. My apologies that Robin Sachs is apparently not available tonight. But what did you think of Jeff Ashton? You know, some more things from the press release. It talks about, the book talks about, if you haven't got the book, click on the link in the show notes and it'll take you to Amazon. You can get it anywhere. The again, the book, Imperfect Justice, Prosecuting Casey Anthony. There's a behind the scenes with the defense. Talks about Jose Baez, his controversial behavior, his bizarre background, lack of experience, the argument about the death penalty is an important thing that was looked at this case, about this case. Was it a death penalty case? Wasn't it a death penalty case? And, you know, we talked a lot about Florida. We did that many times during the time that we did interviews about Anthony and all the document dumps that Florida would send out. They have a different way of letting things into the media. It didn't sound like Jeff Ashton was too keen about that. And pre-trial publicity, say that three times real fast, is certainly something. And then talking about the therapists that took a look at Casey Anthony and talked to her, and the contradiction about the sexual abuse, we all remember that. And don't get me wrong, I don't feel sorry for George Anthony totally. There are some things about his life that I do feel sorry for, loss of his granddaughter, the loss of his daughter, the whole hornet's nest of craziness that went on in that family. And it's too bad. You don't want that for anyone. Cindy Anthony, on the other hand, well, you could probably write a book just about her. So I guess we're going to end the show a little bit sooner than later, and I apologize for that. I don't like doing that, but unfortunately Robin Sachs is not available this evening. So that's it. We're going to call it a night. I hope you enjoyed the show. I hope you go out and buy Imperfect Justice. My name's Dana Pretzer, and we'll see you again real soon.
You've been listening to the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at scaredmonkeysradio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guest websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of scaredmonkeys.com. Thanks for listening.